He shaves his head, by the way. At least that's what he tells me. I'm not sure I believe. I mean, he must wax it too, because I don't see any any like follicles whatsoever. Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It's September 21st, 2017. That's many years of time that have elapsed since the start of time. And this is a podcast that is on its 540th episode, which is also a great many. That was a connecting thought. I'm joined today by Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And Mr. Guillaume Vaillette.
Time is a flat circle.
I don't even know what, like I've always, that expression's always escaped me because I don't, well, like, the idea that time is cyclical, but not really.
But also, it's a dumb quote from a TV show that I haven't watched, but
how
can a circle be what? It doesn't make sense. Anyway.
Well, I mean, a circle, time is an abstract concept that we have applied to our existence.
If time is a drug, then Big Ben is a giant needle injecting it into the sky.
Well, not for the next 4 years.
It's still a clock.
It's just not going to be audible.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Clock's running.
It's still there. Like I do like the idea that we're just going to tear it down. We'll put it back in 4 years. Nobody gets to see the time. We're just going to cover it in a big tarp for 4 years for fun. I do wonder, though, like, when people listen to this show, what time is it where you're at right now? Because for us, it's late, and we're wasting your time by talking about time. But I hope we're wasting your time effectively. And we're going to start by talking about our favorite time waster, sports. I mean, video games. Greg, you have a video game that unfortunate listeners of the show may have heard played last week by someone who's not here. We fired him for his miscreant behavior.
He'll never come back. So I did get Metroid Samus Returns a little bit after John did, because I was waiting for the physical copy in the mail, but played it pretty solidly in the ensuing week. I've beaten it twice, and I'm working on the fusion mode now, because I have that squishy amiibo that unlocks that.
Nice.
Yeah, but that's a sort of a long way ahead of where we need to begin. So yeah,
that's quite a few playthroughs already, though.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, the nice thing about a portable Metroid, is that I could just sort of rip into it unencumbered, like, you know, when the Prime games are coming out, or Other M, or, you know, with the console stuff,
right?
You have to kind of end up pacing myself a bit more, but you go back to, you know, it's been so long since these kinds of Metroid games are coming out. I mean, when I played Zero Mission and Fusion, like, I didn't even have a lit screen handheld. You know, like, I was playing on the launch GBA. Or latterly, the Game Boy Player, so it was like a console game at that point, or it was like under a lamp or whatever. So, I mean, yeah, like, it's quite a lot of fun, actually, to just kind of have it in this portable form, well, with a nice screen, or just absolutely rip into it and just play the living shit out of it in a short period of time. In short, I've enjoyed it very much. I think it lives up to the sort of expectations that I had in most respects. I've got some kind of quibbles and things, but nothing major. Bottom line is, you know, they kind of nailed the mechanics, I feel like, you know, because it felt like it could be a bit different going for the polygonal art style and Mercury Steam as the developer and all that. You know, would it have the same sort of feel as Zero Mission? But largely it does, in terms of, you know, the sort of the timing of things, the weight of the jumps, and the, you know, the sort of physics of the morph ball and stuff like that. All feels pretty authentic and stuff. But to go into some of the kind of elements of the game, presentationally, I think it's a little bit more Metroid Prime than I was expecting. You know, given that, you know, Sakamoto's overseeing it, who's never been associated with the Metroid Prime games, directly, and then, you know, Mercury Steam, of course, doing the heavy lifting on the development. But, you know, of course, with the composers and stuff, you know, there's overlap there sound-wise, and certainly there's a lot of Metroid Prime in the sound work. You get
I think Metroid Prime has also sort of permeated what the Metroid iconography is.
It has, and this kind of started a bit in Zero Mission, actually. You know, like, even Zero Mission compared to Fusion, like, the sort of synth choir and this kind of stuff, like, it was starting to do that. But, of course, on GBA, there were limits to how much you could kind of go, whereas now, I mean, you've got songs in this, all these years later, in the sort of succession of handheld hardware, that are essentially like embellished versions of Prime songs. So they sound even richer and better than they did in the Prime game. So, you know, like we've come a long way in that respect compared to Zero Mission, and now it can really kind of bring that kind of tone authentically.
So you're saying Metroid is a flat circle?
You've got the, you know, you've got like all the fanfares are pretty much straight out of Metroid Prime. Like I said, you've got kind of classic remixes of like a lot of Super Metroid stuff that sort of began in Prime, but now, like I said, have been kind of further enhanced, like the Magmal Caverns for the ridiculously hot areas, and the kind of lower Brinstar for the kind of watery areas that appeared in Metroid Prime 2. It comes back here and stuff, so yeah, that gives it a kind of Prime vibe. And then also, you know, just the kind of art design and stuff definitely kind of reminded me a bit of Prime. That you, because you've got these polygonal graphics, you know, with the 3D effect as well, you get a much bigger sort of sense of scale. You know, I talked about looking forward to that. It's very much delivered on that. You know, you really do get that contrast between being in these sort of tight little caverns and then being out somewhere where there's a gigantic like dam, you know, for an underground river just that stretches way into the distance, arcing round. You know, the stereoscopic 3D can really convey things like that, and I think that kind of helped, that sense of scale kind of reminds me a little bit of Prime, even though it's very obviously very, very different perspective. And then also, like I said, just the aesthetic sort of components, you know, like a lot of, because you've Metroid 2, the original, being so limited, so basic on Game Boy, there's a lot that needed filling in terms of like, okay, how are these play? You know, we've got this big world, and it is very large, you know, quite significantly bigger than something like Zero Mission. So how are we going to differentiate the locations now? Whereas on Game Boy, it was black, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Now, right. So there's a lot of art design that's gone into it, and I feel like they've kind of lent on some of the things that were done in Prime in terms of like Chozo technology and statues and all this kind of stuff coming in. And, you know, I really do like the look of it. Ultimately, I mean, I don't know, maybe I've been playing it on the little 3DS, my new 3DS that's got the smaller size, so I guess it's not quite, you know, scrutinized so much in terms of textures and stuff, but I think the trade-off was worth it to go to the polygonal graphics to really make use of the stereoscopic 3D and everything. As much as I like pixel art, you know, and especially like Zero Mission and Super Metroid pixel art, I just feel like you're getting something, you know, different here thanks to the stereoscopic effect, and it lets them do some things with camera moves and, you know, little cinematic flourishes and all that, which it just, especially at this point where so even, you know, Nintendo games are just foregoing 3D altogether.
Yeah.
It's really nice to see one that pushes it and makes great use of it.
Well, and I do wonder, you know, this being the whole, like, terrarium, where's that word again, look for that Metroid's always kind of had, where you're sort of running through a side view of a space, giving it 3D in that case actually gives depth to a world that otherwise just looks like, man, why do the pirates always just build tiny, narrow hallways?
Yeah, like I said, it just differentiates it more as well, you know, the feeling of going on some sort of journey. You know, it's right. A lot more pronounced. Like, obviously, you know, it was very problematic in the original Metroid 2, but now,
oh my,
you know,
God,
with the variety of, you know, kind of, you go to sort of, you know, very kind of nature dominated areas to kind of very industrial or like, you know, kind of high tech areas and all that, you know, and being able to bring out those contrasts so much more with 3D and stuff. It's it probably, you know, of the side scrollers, it's got the best sense of being in a whole bunch of different places and the sense of scale and all that. That's just one of the reasons why I'm really pleased that, you know, the 2D strand of the series managed to come back in time, perhaps just in time to get, you know, to make use of this feature.
I did go back and listen to some of our retroactive on Metroid 2 Return of Samus, which is kind of a bad mouthfeel of a name, so I get why they renamed it. That was 193, so eons ago. But late enough that we were calling the show like, wow, that's a lot of episodes.
Sure.
We were like, that's something that, and I remembered hating the game perspective and just looking at the world and feeling constrained and claustrophobic, but we really hit on that. Like it was something that made us crazy. And so it's kind of amazing it took this long to remake this game when you think about it. I mean, granted, we know there was another remake that came out recently for this game.
yes. The need for it has been there since 91.
since the day it came out. Because you have to remember, on the Game Boy, you're talking about an even more restrained view than on like a 4:3 TV.
Oh, yeah. If you jumped, you couldn't see the floor anymore. That's kind of a problem.
No, obviously, so the low res nature of the Game Boy is going to create some problems straight away. But the choice to go for that chunky, detailed Samus sprite was a big problem for a game of that type.
We were losing it about the fact that when enemies would go off screen, they would effectively respawn. And that, like, the Metroids that you're fighting in the game world would, like, go off-screen?
I don't think they would respawn so much as they would freeze, no? But they would be invulnerable. Like, you had to kind of get a little bit closer to them to unfreeze again and to be able to fight them.
It was something like that, and that because they were literally right off the edge of the screen, you would just run into them.
Yeah.
And it's just a complete mess. But, yeah, like, it's kind of... It is kind of amazing that it took this long for this game to get fixed. I mean, fixed is the word for it.
Well, that's the thing. It's an interesting thing because there's a lot about this game that's very different. You know, and it's all, you know, you could say it's, you know, kind of a disservice.
A loose reimagining?
Yeah, well, I don't know. The nomenclature with this kind of
soft stuff. A soft reboot?
I'm not gonna get into that kind of stuff, but, you know, it's mainly kind of a remake of Metroid 2 in the same way that sort of Castlevania 4 is a remake of Castlevania 1 in terms of, like, the scenario is the same, mm-hmm. but there's not really that much else that's the same, you know what I mean? Like there's a great deal of differences, you know, many different, like, you know, power-ups and abilities and stuff. You know, there's a lot been added to it and changed and all that, but of course, but there are still, you know, that those core similarities with the scenario and you know, certain elements of the structure. And I guess that's what the most interesting thing for me about this has been, like I said, because it's so much bigger than some 2D Metroids that, you know, the warp point that we brought up last week about, yeah, you know, I mean, I could see why they added them because, you know, it is kind of, you know, kind of somewhat necessary, I feel like, to make going back to previous kind of areas more palatable if you're trying to mop up on collected items. But the fact is, structurally, this game is perhaps even more so than Fusion, a kind of episodic quest. You know, each area is pretty discreet from the others. There's no doubt you'll see things in an area that it's like, oh, this block can be destroyed by the screw attack or something like that. And it's like, well, you're not going to, intuitively from previous Metroid games, you know you're not going to get that for a while, you know, because it's early on. So you know straight away that you would have to come back to these areas if you want to get 100% of the items. But in terms of progression, There isn't the same kind of like intercutting, you know, between areas that there was in sort of like Super Metroid or Zero Mission. So it's more like Fusion in that way. Although even Fusion has a certain amount of kind of mandatory coming back to some of the areas that were numbered in that. In this, it really is more of a kind of within each individual area. You've got this kind of the sort of sector that you'll need to collect new powers to be able to traverse and to kill all the Metroids that you need to for you to be able to reach the next sector. You know, so in that sense, it's got the sort of similar structure to the original, except now they've somewhat explained more like why killing Metroids lets you go deeper into the planet. Before, it was just like, well, you kill them and an earthquake happens and there you go.
Show them who's boss.
Although it's all wordless. I'm sure people will be glad to know that there is no kind of heavy-handed dialogue, storytelling, or anything like that from Fusion or Other M or anything like that. But, the point being that each area you get your particular kinds of items, you get kill your requisite number of Metroids, and then you move on, and really you wouldn't have to go back after that to that area. You can if you're, oh, I got a new beam or something, and I know that's going to unlock a door that I saw before, and I want to go back and get that, and the warp system could make it very quick to do that too. I mean, especially if I didn't really do this, just because, you know, leaning more on my sort of already existing Metroid playing habits, but if I'd like use the whole putting markers on the map thing more aggressively, it probably would have been a fair bit quicker to get 100%, because it would have been okay, you know, I've just seen something that I know, you know, I would a particular kind of beam unlock, so I can put a color marker down there and say, okay, later on when I'm like, I want to mop up all those doors that I can now open, I could just pick the closest warp point and go right to it. So it's there for you if you want to go back and get more items and kind of power up a little bit, but there's no obligation to do that. So it's just a sort of succession of these kind of little non-linear adventures through the planet killing Metroids until the end of the game. So like I said, structurally it's certainly not Zero Mission. You know, in many respects it's quite similar in terms of the mechanics, and I think in general the design is, you know, similarly sort of intricate and clever in terms of like particular, you know, creating a lot of a narrow passageway stuff. You're using the morph ball, and of course now you're bringing the spider ball into that, which is something that, you know, comes from the original Metroid 2, but it's used in a much more kind of purposeful and structured way here than it was in that, where it felt kind of like a cool thing, but they didn't really know what to do with it, and I just sort of ended up very slowly rolling around the tops of big rooms for no particular reason. You still do move quite slowly in spider ball form here, a little slower than I'd like, but I think it's part of trying to communicate, like, this is not really something you're meant to be traversing big areas with. It's meant to be a kind of more of a short area kind of power up that you're going to be using for your particular circumstances. Although there's some bits where, you know, you get to places you couldn't go before, mostly, you know, early on in the first sort of few kind of areas after you get the spider ball, where you might travel for a little bit in that form. But so that's why I say I could have used with being a bit quicker, but I understand, you know, what they were trying to communicate with that, and I think generally they make good use of that. The grapple beam is something that's coming into this game, you know, that it didn't have before, you know, because that was introduced in Super Metroid originally. And I mean, the one thing with the grapple beam is always kind of that it's rendered redundant by the space jump and things like that. But Here, you know, that happens to some extent, but you know, the one thing I like is that they do manage to find a separate usefulness for it. And again, it's quite in some quite sort of clever, confined spaces kind of ways that they do that, you know. So it's all these kind of intricacies to the moment to moment design and all that, they're all there. But what you don't have from Zero Mission is the way that things kind of interconnect with each other and kind of loop back around. I guess it's just first of all, you know, adhering to the Metroid 2 structure doesn't really lend itself to that, I guess. And secondly, it's just too big for that, really. Which I think, in general, you know, what this game is, you know, in terms of, for a first playthrough, I think the difficulty balance and the length of the game probably make it substantially more satisfying for most players than Zero Mission was. You know, if you asked me, if I was doing this after my first playthrough of Zero Mission 13 years ago, I would have said, yeah, it was good, but a bit short, a bit easy, you know, and that would have been about it, really. But, right. You know, it's really with the replays and all that that I came to have as much affection for it as I do now. This game, certainly, I wonder whether it will be as replayable, even though I've already replayed it once.
I was about to say, wait a minute.
But, I mean, we're talking about several times with Zero Mission over a period of years. I do wonder whether it's going to hold up to that kind of scrutiny in this case with Samus Returns. But, you know, in terms of for now, like I said, the difficulty balance, the length of the game and all that, it felt really quite satisfying in a way that Zero Mission did not so much back when I played that for the first time in 2004. So it's definitely got that on its side. I think one of the problems of kind of adhering to the Metroid 2 structure is the repetition with sort of these mini boss fights that are killing the Metroids. I mean, the first form is kind of so simple that they're not really, you know, it's kind of a perfunctory fight. You know, unless you're playing in fusion mode when it can like kill you in one hit if you get something a little wrong. But, you know, it's almost like, well, you found it. It's more about finding it than it is about killing it. And then the latter forms I quite like that are more complicated and there's not that many of them. It's really the Gammas, the sort of second tier, that there's a few too many of them. And in some cases, they actually intentionally like draw the fight out a bit by having this sort of notion of it sort of you fight it for a bit and then it'll sort of slip away and go to like another nesting place and you have to track it down. Yeah, those kind of wore on me a little bit, you know, poorly designed encounter in itself, but it seems a bit stretched when you end up fighting that many of them. But they did decide to adhere to the sort of the premise of, you know, eliminating all the Metroids and all that and having the different, you know, life cycle stages and all that. And I just kind of feel like maybe deviating from it a little bit more and getting a bit more boss variety in there would have been beneficial, especially compared to something like Fusion. It's not as strong in terms of variety and imagination in the bosses, but you know, there are definitely some good ones in there. And again, to go back to the Metroid Prime part, there's one in particular which is very Metroid Prime-esque in terms of its long and multi-stage and quite intricate design involving the Morph Ball and all this. It's just like, well, this is a Prime boss fight in 2D. You know, and I'm not always that fond of Retro Studios' approach to the boss design in terms of they can be overlong.
They always like grind it out.
It's very, very long to play out, and it's like I'm sure you could kind of condense this and get a lot of the good stuff out and just make it feel a bit more intense and quick, rather than a kind of war of attrition. But to have, first of all, it's still quicker than one of those. In the other Prime games, it's just in that vein. But also to have one that stands out, I feel like is you know, I'm okay with that. You know, it's when they sort of stack on top of each other that the fatigue can kind of set in and all that. So, you know, I think it's a funny one. It like I said, in some ways I feel like it's most similar to Fusion, but then on the other hand, it's not at all like Fusion because it's so hands off. compared to, you know, there's no, like, even compared to Zero Mission, which was obviously very much a reversion back to kind of not having a lot of text or whatever, but it did have those beacons that were like, okay, head towards this point in the map, even though the map is not really, like, very filled in at this point. That's your general direction to go. Here, you have less of that even. I mean, you're always brought back to the core goal of killing the Metroids, and then you come back to a place that will allow you to progress once you've achieved that. So that kind of keeps you on task. But there's really not a lot of explicit guidance and all that. I mean, you can ask for help, essentially. There's a statue that can kind of point you in the right direction if you're looking for, like, the last Metroid you need. It will kind of give you a beacon of the sort of little discarded, like, shed skin of the Metroid, the shell that it's left behind as it's mutated into its next form or whatever, to sort of put you on the right track. That's there if you want it. You've got the whole Aeon thing, the scan pulse, which could kind of reveal bits of the map for you. The first playthrough, I didn't use that at all, basically. The other Aeon abilities you're going to need to use at various times to achieve certain things. But that one is pretty much optional. So the first time I played through the game, got 100% without using it at all. I kind of felt like I'll just use my standard Metroid instincts about where to bomb, where to prod, and all that kind of stuff. And it was fine.
You've been trained well.
It was absolutely fine. It was not like, okay, the fact that we've got this scan pulse ability means we can be more obtuse now, or something, you know, like that they felt they had the license to make it like less. It's still intuitive,
which is kind of unfaithful to the original Metroid 2, I find, because they, yeah. I don't know, they didn't feel compelled to make it intuitive all the time, I don't think. There were, I don't know, maybe because I was younger, like I didn't notice and because it was my first Metroid, I didn't notice the clues that some walls were bombable, but usually it was mostly like, okay, there's probably going to be something 3 tiles off the floor, like I'm going to be able to bomb there and go through there, and that's basically it. But I don't remember kind of like, you know, signs of a damaged wall or something to indicate like, oh, you can bomb here. And yeah, like the lack of color and everything just didn't leave you with many clues at all for which walls could be gone through. So some walls you could just go through, right? Like you went behind them without even bombing.
Yeah, and, like that. I mean, that's a thing in a number of Metroid games, actually. And it's kind of notable for its absence here. I don't think there's any of that. There's no trick walls, if you like, you know, where it's like, okay, well, it looks like a wall, but it turns out it's hollow, and you just move through it. There's no bombing or anything. It's just, there is actually none of that, as far as I can remember. So it's kind of very consistent. The map is very informative. So, for instance, you'll be able to see, say, if a door is one way. So, you know, in certain cases, it's like, okay, well, you know, a door kind of does not function. If you come in from a certain side, it'll tell you that. Because that is something that can annoy you sometimes if you're navigating, like, Super Metroid. It's kind of, you look at the map and it looks like, well, these two rooms are connected, but they're connected by a one-way door. So if you approach them from one side, they're not connected. You know? So,
right.
But with this, it's very, everything's broken down by, you know, like, if you've seen a collectible but couldn't get it, not only will it mark that there's a collectible there for you to come back and get, it'll mark what it is as well.
That's phenomenal, because that's one of those things where it's like you have to keep track of it in your head, and that's not fun.
And like I said, don't forget, you can also add your own markings too, as I said before. Oh. So, I mean, the map is super informative anyway, and it's very transparent. But then you can make it more so, like I said, which would be helpful, I think, for going back to get 100%, even though I didn't do that, because it's one of the side effects of playing a bunch of old Metroid games before you get this, is that you end up playing it like an old Metroid game, even if it isn't exactly the same. But yeah, so all these things I feel like are really kind of cool, and it just gave them the confidence to leave it to you. You know, like you could, if you want help, you can get it. But if you don't, you know, you could just figure it out yourself. And the design is robust enough that it works really nicely in that way. And, you know, for me, I kind of got to the end having quite, you know, took quite a while. I think I ended up sort of getting to the very end of about 12 hour mark, although I'd almost got every item and then quickly kind of having, you know, seen the end of the game. Went back and mopped everything up in pretty short order, so you know, quite a long game. But then the task for me was okay. I want to do the, you know, it's got the usual sort of Metroid thing of you've got to get under a certain time to see Samus without the helmet and then out of the suit entirely. So and the time for out of the suit entirely is 4 hours, and I was like, wow, like that. Seems tight, that, you know, like Super Metroid was 3, and Super Metroid, you know, seems, you know, a lot less big, you know, in terms of real estate. So I was thinking, God, this could be tight. And so I sort of made my first run at it, and I thought, well, what I'll do this time is I'll use that Eon ability to scan the map. I'll abuse the hell out of it. I'll use my memory of the game that I've just played and that together to kind of streamline the speedrun process a bit, and do my best with it. And then I got to the very end of the game and beat the last boss, and my runtime was 4 hours and 2 minutes. So it was like, oh shit, I just missed it. But I hadn't saved like for a little while, so I was able to you know, get the economy going until I got under the 4 hours by a couple of minutes. And that was really fun because it was like it was almost like a completely different game, you know, using the Eon ability to help me with the map. And obviously I'm rushing, so I'm not collecting everything. So the difficulty was much, much different. I finished that run with 14% of the items instead of like 90 the first time. So you can imagine like the last boss and all that goes, it's a very different experience and all that. And the game played really well that way too. So, you know, that's a pretty high compliment, I'd say.
Yeah, I've barely had the time to touch it. I think I thought the first night that I got it on Monday, I had put in a couple of hours, but then I picked it back up the next day and I had put in about an hour. Like, I don't know. I felt like I made a lot of progress fast because I got a spider ball pretty early. But then again, you got the spider ball really early in the original too. Yeah. So, but then I've got 16% and I don't know. I don't know what all of those numbers mean, really, because I haven't gone through the game once yet. But
I mean, there's a lot of items. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of items that, like I said, you don't particularly need.
Right.
Like I said, I mean, going through it on normal, you know, being able to reach the end of the game with 14%, because there's a lot of stuff to upgrade. You've got your Eon upgrades and your usual missiles and health tanks and all that stuff. You know, so there's a lot of stuff to find, but you don't necessarily need to find it. I mean, the most obvious metric is the number of Metroids left, as much as anything.
Right. I haven't looked at the counter.
Yeah, that they keep that on the title screen, on the save file for you. Yeah. But I guess one thing that I'm interested to hear about from your thoughts on the early game, though, is the counter. We kind of talked about that. You know, there's some concern about how much it would bog down the pace and all that. And for my money, I kind of felt like it was most relevant early on, because as it goes on, your arsenal expands and you have more and more options for how to deal with enemies. And it the counter becomes less relevant, except, you know, for boss fights, you know, in which case they can be, you know, kind of a big help. But in terms of early on, I felt like it was a lot more like, okay, and God, especially if you're playing in hard, you know, there's no getting around it. You need to be able to nail that and kill enemies, you know, that way. I was just interested what you made of it so far.
Yeah, it took me a while to figure out you were talking about the parry and not the Metroid counter.
Parry.
Oh, sorry. So, yeah,
I had the same thought because we transitioned out, but once you said it really only matters in the early game, he meant the counter.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm using it, you know, in the early game. Usually, I like the rhythm of the combat with it. Like, it's pretty neat because the enemies are bullet sponges, which is not great, but they were kind of bullet sponges in the original Metroid 2.
Yeah.
But I'm more used to Super Metroid, where a lot of enemies are really one-hit kills, and you get into, or I got into the habit of just basically running, once I get the speed booster, running into whoever is in front of me while shooting diagonally up, which you can't do here, you know, to take care of whatever could be coming from above. And like pretty early on, I find in Super Metroid, you kind of become a tank that's unstoppable. Here, you know, you start out, you're much more fragile, the enemy are bullet sponges, but then if you parry, you can usually one-hit kill most enemies. So I like the feeling of that. What was the other thing?
Why can't Samus take a punch? Why can't Metroid take a punch, is what you're telling me?
The thing is, it kind of changes, yeah, like the way that I would usually play a game, like with the thumb resting on the run button and constantly tapping the shoot button. And instead of that, you know, the thumb resting on the parry button and just like really ready for, you know, the enemy that are not as close to you when they appear on screen as they were in the original Game Boy game, but they're still pretty damn close. Like they see you coming from as soon as you're on the same screen as them. And so, yeah, like I think it's a good change overall.
Like, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like I said, I don't feel it bogs down the exploration too much. That was the big fear, you know, that if it was going to have a downside, that would be it. And I don't feel that way, certainly because, like I said, it sort of fades in relevance in the sort of exploratory phases of the game as it goes on, because you start to get beams where, you know, you could say, well, I can take this enemy out from a distance before it's even, you know, gonna have a chance to rush me or whatever, and then I need to parry it away. But in the early going, you know, like I said, you do kind of feel obliged to use it, as you said, because it is the quickest way to kill enemies. You know, because as you said, then you one-shot them afterwards. But certainly as soon as you get the ice beam, that starts to change in terms of a lot of enemies can be killed quite quickly by freezing them and then shattering them, which can be done with a missile, but it can also actually be done with the parry itself. You can just sort of swish your arm and shatter them.
Oh.
Which is a funny little technique. I only discovered that on the second playthrough. I didn't even think about it before. But yeah, if you want to just like run up to stuff and just like quickly freeze it and go swish, and then it shatters, which is fun. You know, so like I said, it's not as limiting as it might seem at first, because it's like, okay, you know, so it's something intrinsically kind of passive about it. It's like, okay, I've got to wait for the enemy to come to me rather than, like you said, I mean, and I know this very well from playing a bunch of Metroid stuff immediately before this game came out. Yeah, that was my instinct of like, I just want to run, I want to shoot, I want to kill, I want to go really fast, you know. And then all of a sudden I saw, oh, now I'm going to stop and wait and all that. But I feel like the way it's implemented, you know, I think it ends up kind of contributing to the sense of empowerment, that at first, you know, that is more incumbent on you to do that, and then later on, you know, you get much closer to the typical kind of Samus walking destruction festival that you expect. But I mean, obviously there are some differences. Just, I mean, for instance, Metroid hasn't had a run button since Super Metroid, right? You know, because fewer buttons on the GBA really kind of contributed to that. But in this case, they sort of retain the basics of Zero Mission by omitting the run button. And that's fine. The character movement, all that, they got that pretty much right. So, you know, that's fine. But, you know, I do feel like, other than, you know, the bosses getting a little bit repetitive and all that kind of stuff, they did a really, really good job here. It just, you know, I've been so thrilled to play this game, you know, to really sink my teeth into it and enjoy the hell out of it. You know, you've got to give credit to Mercury Steam, you know, for getting this right. You know, I mean, obviously they've got Nintendo supervision in this, but like I said, it's the counter parry stuff is a world away from the combos of Lords of Shadow on Castlevania on 3DS. It's, you know, if anybody had visions of that, you know, that it would descend into that, it's nothing like that. You don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I just like the little steps that they took to make the just the gameplay a little bit faster, like the power-ups, just you track them no matter where you are, like, so
yeah, it's kind of it's kind of like
you know, kind of jump off a ledge and then come back immediately, you know, and then risk falling down like after you've been climbing up a whole lot. Like,
yeah, I do like that. That kind of helps keep exploration brisk, because I mean, it's kind of like the whole thing in Metroid Prime of tracked and stuff with the charge thing,
right?
But
actually even with
having
less
to charge it,
yeah, with less BS.
yeah, no, and, so I'm definitely happy with that. Yeah, little things like that, and I mean with the counter and whatnot, I mean there are certain aspects of the game, there's some good, like some wise decisions. I feel like there's a few little fiddly elements in the controls, I would actually say, that could be, because the thing is, again, you've got a bigger kind of move set than you did in Zero Mission, which is cool in a way, you know, you're getting more, you know, that you're bringing things in that you didn't have there, but it also like makes it a bit more convoluted. It's not quite as streamlined as that was, you know. So for instance, like, you are bringing in the grapple beam, the ice beam is a separate thing now, so it's a little bit more like in Prime, where the other beam stack, but that one does not, that's a separate thing, because it's kind of a different kind
it's got
use.
An effect on it,
yeah, exactly, and that as I said, can be way more effective against certain kinds of enemies, you know, so it kind of gives you different ways to kill stuff, but then you've got to flick between them, but you do that using the touch screen on the kind of just touch the icons on the lower screen next to the map, and that's how you flick between things. But there's just one thing with, like, there's some smart decisions, as I said, where, for instance, when you do get the grapple beam, if you do the thing where you hold L and you aim in place, if you've got your regular gun out but you're pointing straight at a grapple point, it will switch automatically to the grapple beam. So that's, you know, something that seems intuitive, you know, it's the sort of thing you should do, right? But obviously it's not something that was in Super Metroid, you know, you had to select the grapple beam along that row with the missiles and everything else. But on the flip side, if you do a counter while you were in the middle of grappling something, it will not snap to the weapon beam. So then you'll just be left with, like, grappling them a little bit, which doesn't do very much.
That'll teach him a lesson.
Because, I mean, it's not going to happen a whole lot of the time, you know, where it's like, but you might be in the middle of, like, there's certain destructible blocks that need to be grappled in order to clear them. And then, you know, I'm in the middle of that, and then, oh shit, an enemy, a quick counter, and you do that, but then when it comes to shooting them, it's, you know, you're like, either you grapple them, which does very little damage, or if you shoot, switch to the beam, by the time you've done that, you've lost that kind of one-hit kill effect that you have immediately after the counter. So it just seems like, you know, that's the logical kind of extension of what they did with the grapple points. It's like, well, of course, I don't want to grapple after a counter, you know? I mean, admittedly, like, you've got the ice, you know, ice, you can use the ice charge after a counter, which totally freezes them, you know, for a long time, like as if you charged it up purposefully. So I can understand it's like, well, you might want to freeze them after the counter, or you might want to use the other beam, but you definitely don't want to grapple them. So I just kind of feel like the safest thing might have been just to have it automatically snap to the regular beam or something. So just little things where you end up switch, you know, flicking between stuff on the touchscreen. Obviously, moving with the analog stick kind of makes going into the morph ball a little more fiddly, because that was a double tap on the D-pad, right. And that's the kind of thing that's really nice to execute on the D-pad, nice and quick, but it can be a little sort of soft and indistinct when you're trying to do that with an analog stick. But they did provide a bit of a workaround situation, because you can tap, if you tap on the touch screen where there isn't an icon, like just on the map, it will take you in and out of morph ball form that way instantly.
Right. Okay.
So the every now and again, when like there was some bits of dodging going on, that was kind of nice to cut out the middleman of like going into the crouch position before going into the morph ball. But you know, with new 3DS, they could have made the controls more customizable and said, you know, like map this to the extra shoulder buttons if you want. But I don't believe they did. I haven't seen anything with the customizable controls or anything like that.
I mean, you've played it front to back multiple times.
So I have, yeah. I mean, just go into options and it says controls and it just shows them. I can't see any way to change them.
Yeah, that's all it is then.
But, you know, for the most part, you don't need to. They function really well. But there's just, you know, just a few things where it's like you've got so many moves and things, it just gets a little bit tricky to manage everything. But, you know, in the main, plays great, really satisfying. Good difficulty balance, and you know, hopefully, we'll be seeing more side-scrolling Metroid games in the future. But you know, it could be a while based on historical precedent.
You people are already complaining about 2D Metroids. God, you just got one.
You know, but it's I mean, look, it's great that it's happened. I'm really thrilled. But it is, you know, like a remake of Metroid. It would be great to get a thoroughly original one again. Isn't a lot of new stuff in this, because there is.
I'm going to say, don't encourage the emails. God.
Well, it's really too bad because Nintendo has a monopoly on this style of game design.
Yeah,
I don't know if the indies will ever catch up.
There's still something special about the real deal.
I'm going to put a moratorium. Yeah, because we can't get our names in the credits for them. Oh, all right. I'm gonna move on now. We've talked a lot about some Metroids. So now we'll talk about a game that's not good. And that's Final Fantasy 15, which I finally got around to playing. So let's pause for a second already. I went for the Final Fantasy 15 experience, which is apparently there's a semi-mandatory movie you have to watch prior to playing the game called Final Fantasy 15 Kingsglaive or Kingsglaive, whatever that fucking thing is called. So it's really bad. And, like, I knew going in it was bad because people are like, you have to watch the movie because the game just doesn't bother explaining any of this shit. But the movie is really bad. And it's long. It's, like, 2 hours long. So here's the thing about that movie. Like, put yourself in the mindset of Final Fantasy VIII. Like, Square Enix, or Square at the time, has just had their big Final Fantasy VII blow-up of, like, this is what a modern Final Fantasy looks like. This is what production values can do. Man, these cinematics in here, because you know, Final Fantasy VII had a handful of cinematics. They really moved the needle on the PR for this game. Fuck it, let's go crazy and just jam Final Fantasy VIII with these. Like, weird movie sequences, characters that don't look all weird and super deformed.
A ballroom scene.
Yeah, a ballroom dancing scene. Extended ballroom dancing scene, please. But no talking, just video. Just like rendered CG video for like 3 or 4 minutes with music set to music and maybe special effects and just a lot of those. Kingsglaive is basically the story equivalent of if you took those movies and removed all context of the game and just strung them together for 2 hours. It's like a bunch of video scenes that don't really make a lot of sense and don't really tell a story. Just going. It's bad. It's trash. I mean, I've talked about it on the show. I used to watch bad movies for fun, and this movie is trash. But people's point of, well, they don't really explain this shit, so you probably should watch it, is unfortunately true, because they don't really explain this shit. You should probably watch it. Because Final Fantasy XV has you playing as the son of the king, the semi-titular Kingsglaive king. As the movie sort of tells how they were how the kingdom was betrayed and they were invaded and he died and why the power of the kings is super important for protecting and why protecting the king who holds that power is important and what that power actually means. Final Fantasy 15, all that takes place over the course of one of the characters reading a newspaper report saying war happened, we lost, king's dead, end. And they talk about the sort of element of power, the thing that represents the power, but they don't actually explain what it does or what it means or why it's important or why everybody's freaking out over it. They just kind of say, eh, it's fine. Most of what Final Fantasy 15, the game, is four bros in a car that you're not controlling, driving down the street for 5 minutes while you have the controller sitting down, and occasionally they say something to each other. That's Final Fantasy 15, the experience. Because there's a lot of time where you say, I would like to go to this town. And they go, okay, let's go, and they get in the car. One of them will say something funny about how the car... I'm using the word funny facetiously here. We'll say something funny about how the car is really tight because one of the characters is big. And then they'll put the top down on the car if the weather's nice, or they'll keep it up if it's not, and then they'll drive for a while. And then occasionally somebody might go like, hey, where do you think all these monsters are going? And somebody else go, should we have a look? And you'll get a prompt on the screen saying stop or don't stop. Or if you stop, you can go see where they're going and maybe you'll find a thing. If you don't stop, you just keep going and eventually you get to your destination. It is an open world game, which is part of the problem, but really just kind of in name only. And so we've talked about open world games on this show a little bit recently. You know, we had Xenoblade Chronicles X, and we had Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. And one thing both of those games nail is that moving around the world and getting around the world is fun. Because if it's not fun, if getting from A to B is just a chore, then if that's a key component of your gameplay design, you've essentially defunded a significant portion of your game. And in Final Fantasy 15, it's literally a chore. It is get in the car and they drive. I once was told it was going to take, quote, approximately 7 minutes to get to my destination. I put the controller down and just hoped we didn't get attacked. I went in the other room, made a sandwich, and came back, and they were still driving.
The famous travel sandwich popularized with Wind Waker.
Yes. But at least in Wind Waker, like, maybe something will happen. Most of the time, if you're driving it, as long as it's daytime, it doesn't seem like anything happens. And then night will happen, and, like, enemies will just pop up everywhere. It's a weird, dumb thing. But, like, it happens all the time, like constantly driving over distances to go nowhere. When you do get out of the car and the game actually lets you off the road, which it doesn't do all the time in all places, you can sort of like go off designated exit points of the road and get out of your car and walk off into the wilderness. And it's all segmented. Like, it'll be like, if you're getting a quest and these are your standard like MMO/open world quests, go kill 5 enemies in this place. Go find thing here. Go deliver item to NPC B. You'll get off the road and you think, okay, this is probably where I'm at. And then you'll run into like rocks that Noctis, who's your main character, can clearly jump over because you have a jump button in a Final Fantasy game. But there's an invisible wall there blocking your ability to go up. So you actually have to go back to the car, which thankfully you can warp to, and drive to the next spot you can get off the road, because actually it's on this next one, not the one you passed first. Or you'll run into like a brocage you just can't get through. It's just bushes. Like, just push through them, dude. I know it'll mess up your coiffed hair, but like, for fuck's sake, just go.
It must be especially jarring after playing Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, it is. Like, cause it's like, here's some rocks Noctis can't climb over. Here's a stream that he can't walk through. And I'm like, it's a fucking stream. He has a sword that he can throw and he teleports to where it lands. Like, why can't he cross a stream? Is he a witch? Like, what's wrong here? But, like, so the combat. I hate the combat. I hate the combat system. It's terrible. Some people like it. I think they're crazy. But basically, it's you hold down a button and Noctis attacks. You hold down another button and sometimes he dodges. Not always. Sometimes he runs out of mana and he can't dodge anymore. You have a health that refills, but it only refills up to a maximum health amount that every time you get knocked out gets slowly ticks down, or you can get hurt and it ticks down in big chunks. Sometimes, however, your health will tick down for no reason I can discern. Noctis wasn't knocked down. Noctis isn't using these weapons they barely explain that take away your health. He just kind of is losing health. I'm not sure what the cause is. Some enemies seem to be able to just take his health away. It's a real pain in the ass. Potions don't heal back the max health. You have to use different, more expensive items to do that. The only way to make money that the game tells you about is hunts. Thanks to Johnny, who yesterday told me I can sell all the crap the enemies drop. I actually don't need them for crafting. So I actually have money, thank God, like 15 hours into the game. The quests kind of suck. The combat is just hold buttons and hope you don't get killed. That's what it feels like. He can warp around a bit, which helps, but usually it's like 20 enemies on screen and they're all swarming Noctis. So like you can't dodge 20 enemies. Like you're fucked. You can't do it. There's a mode called passive mode where the game slows down and stops when he isn't moving. It is not on by default. The game doesn't really tell you to turn it on, but there's a bunch of skills devoted entirely to passive mode, so I hope you figure it out, including the one that lets you find out what enemies' weaknesses are, to the point where Gladio will tell you, check their weaknesses, and you're like, I fucking can't. I don't know how to do it, game. You told me to do it in passive mode, but what's passive mode? So figure that out, put it in passive mode. Like, this game just, it's not telling a story very compellingly. Like, just the characters talk sometimes. Occasionally meet another NPC who talks. It doesn't really feel like there's any real rhyme or reason to the route they're taking to do stuff. They're trying to get to another continent. We've gotten there now, thankfully. But, like, they spent the whole game trying to get there. Like, they get to the harbor. The harbor's closed. They go back to the capital. The capital's been bombed to shit. They go back to the harbor. Like, and it takes forever to do this. They stop in a city and, like, fix the power station. There's no real, like, hard story. It's just like, well, we have to get there because she's there. Okay, why are you going to find her? I don't know, because that's where we were going originally. Well, shit's changed, bro. like the back of the box is, he's out to reclaim his throne. He hasn't talked about taking his throne back at all. At all. He's bitched about it. Noctis is a whiny little shit. But he actually hasn't gone, like, I'm going to take it back.
Are you sure you just didn't miss, like, maybe there's a cereal you didn't eat, or
I didn't watch the anime, so maybe that's where he talks about it. But like, he's basically just whining, and he doesn't. I mean, like, yeah, I'm whining right now, but like, he doesn't seem to have any initiative. It's like, he's a fucking awful character. He just is. And then like, the story's not really driving very hard. Seren said she liked its leisurely pace. I find it insufferable. And it's because it's like, why do you care? Like, you don't see you when you left the capital, which is called Insomnia, which is fucking appropriate. Like, you just didn't seem to want to be there. And like, okay, you've lost your kingdom. You don't really seem to give a shit. Like, he got mad about it when he heard about it. But then they're back in the car cracking wise. So like, maybe I don't fucking know. Also, he's wanted, and they're driving with the top down on a highway in a one of a kind giant car. Because I don't know reasons. Like, there's just so much just. But you get out of the car and, like, enemies attack you all the time, including the Imperials who just show up out of nowhere, and they're level 47s, and there's 12 of them because fuck you, and you're only level 19, and you're over-leveled for this point of the game. But here they are. Oh, you died. Isn't that funny? It's not? Oh, I'm sorry. Like, one time they spawned at my car. Like, I got out of the car, and then I hear one of the characters go, look overhead, and it's an Imperial dropship, and I go, fuck. I'm like, all right, let's go kill these guys. And they get out, and they're level 42. And I'm like 21, and like I said, I'm over-leveled, and they're surrounding my car, so I can't get to my car. I stay out of their hostile circle, but you can't get in your car while there's enemies near your car, and they have effectively stolen my car. So I try the warp back to my car thing, thinking maybe that'll despawn them. They're still there, at which point they beat the shit out of us. So I warp back to the last city I was in, stay the night, and then go back to my car, hoping they're gone, which thankfully they were.
Ugh.
Like, this game, here's the thing. This is a bad game masquerading as a good game. What I mean by that is they polished it a lot presentationally. And I mean, like, the game world is really interesting to look at. But the gameplay sucks. The story sucks. The characters are just garbage. They're trash tier garbage. Like, none of the characters are like your leading character. They're all kind of like your best friend character, or maybe even less than that, like the other friend. And so there's nobody here with like a strong personality driving things forward. The game is occasionally goofy, and like that's fine, but like I don't really feel like they have any kind of motivation. Occasionally you'll run into some supernatural stuff that's kind of interesting, but everybody talks about how it's weird, but then they don't talk about it again ever. And it's like, well, we need to go find all the gods and talk to them. Why? Well, because you didn't read some piece of arcane lore about this game that we're not going to bother explaining. That's why. I don't get it. Like, I don't get how this game is so much is wrong with it. And the other, and like, it feels reductionist to say that the open world stuff was so ill-advised that it's the root cause of all of this. It's definitely the root cause of the quest structure. I mean, quests like this have been up in RPGs forever, but there's so many of them. And that's the way to earn money and get experience. the enemies that you fight are kind of cruddy, and the combat system is not particularly engaging. Like you could use Noctis to warp around like crazy and maybe not take a bunch of damage, and it would look cool, but it would get really repetitive and take forever. It's just there's like the magic. Here's an example of how this combat system doesn't work right. So Noctis has to harness magic from the ground. There's elementals that pop up at various spawn places and they regenerate over time. And there's fire, electricity, and ice. That's it. That's all the magic. And so you can combine them to get different stuff, but that's basically it. And you mount magic to his equipment wheel like an item, and then you throw it on the battlefield, and it has an area of effect. It hurts your guys as well as the enemy. But it's almost impossible to throw it at the enemy and not hit your team, because odds are they've already dove into the fight to mix it up, including the character with basically no health who has a gun who should be staying away from the fight. So the only way to use magic a lot of times is either get way ahead of your team and run the risk of just getting caught there by yourself and popping it, or just know you're going to hit them and just say, well, it is what it is. And you can get too far ahead of your team, because I just finished a dungeon where I was ahead of them, and then the gate would close behind me and the enemies would spawn. But because they were getting caught on the walls and stuff, they ended up on the other side of the gate and couldn't help me, and the game didn't quietly teleport them into the room with me. So I had to fight enemies that were meant to be fought with the team on my own for most of the dungeon. And I would wait for them to catch up, and one of them never caught up until the boss fight, when a cutscene warps them all back into the room together. It was miserable, and I wasted tons of expensive items just healing because Noctis was all by himself, including an AI character who's supposed to be escorting you in that scene, who also got stuck in the wall or on a wall or something stupid. So it was awful. So yeah, this is a game masquerading as a game better than it is. I'm about a little over halfway. I kind of want to just finish it because I just want to get there, but I think I'm just going to beeline it now. Like, I'm just trying to experience the world and do stuff, but I'm just going to finish the damn thing, and I could probably do it in a few hours, maybe 4 or 5 hours, and just be done. But
have you considered just not playing again?
I just want to finish it. That's kind of where I'm at. I sat through the awful movie, and I've overleveled my characters to the point now where the story fighting is way too easy. But things in the field are just still all over the place crazy. Kind of like in a Xenoblade, where there would be strong enemies and weak enemies. So if I just beeline the story, I'll probably not have to grind anymore. And I just go through it and just finish it and be done. But yeah, there's so much that just isn't working in this game. It's kind of a shock, considering how long it was in. Maybe that's it. Maybe it was in development so long because they knew. The combat is what it is. The open world gameplay, I think, was a mistake. They've tried to turn this into a game as a service retroactively. They're adding a multiplayer mode, an online multiplayer mode. They've added a bunch of other chapters. They've had all these kinds of weird cross promotions. This game is chocked to the brim with paid product placement. It's amazing. It's legitimately shocking how much is in this game, and how much of this game is just not good and weird. And so I don't know, I'm not gonna talk about it anymore. It's just, this game's not good, and I'm bummed out by it, and it should be better considering how much money was clearly spent on it, but it is what it is. And to quote John's favorite phrase, this transmedia property is a trash media property. So on that, Guillaume.
Yeah, well, I think my new business is gonna be shorter. I don't have as much to say about, I don't have a...
You don't have a spleen to vent or a brand new game in the first 9 or 15 years to talk about?
Yeah. So to take a break from some of the beat 'em ups that I've been playing lately, I decided I had been hankering for a shoot 'em up. And I had seen screenshots of Aerial Fighters 2, ACA Neo Geo
Aero Fighters 2.
Aero Fighters 2, and I saw that one of the pilots you can select is a dolphin, and I
he
was
sure
like,
is.
That's hilarious.
You're frying over the jungle.
Yeah, you're frying over the jungle, and you want some fish. So those are some of the cutscenes that you can see. And I was like, okay, that looks like wacky and funny, but also kind of has a cool look to it. And I like kind of the more military-looking shoot 'em ups, kind of like Raiden or some other ones that escape me right now. But anyway, so I thought, like, okay, what the hell? This looks cool. So I bought it, played a little bit with Karen. We had a good time, but by default, the you've got infinite continues. And that's an issue that I, you know, that's an issue I have with Neo Geo games or arcade games, you know, that I've emulated sometimes. You can just keep pumping quarters into them, and you've got, you know, basically you can keep trying and trying until you get it. And
yeah, if it hasn't got a checkpoint structure is where you run right into a problem with that. Like say, for instance, if you had infinite continues on R-Type, it's still really difficult because you go back to a checkpoint and it is just tough to get through, you know, from like the mid-level checkpoint to the end of the level without dying. But if it's a case of, you know, instant restart, then you just, you kind of cheese it. And, you know,
it's from the arcades ultimately. Like,
but there were arcade games that weren't like that, is my point. No. Right. You know, Splatterhouse is another.
It was more common though, because they wanted you to immediately panic and go, if I don't put the money in now, I'm going to lose that progress.
Yeah, sure. Right. I get the logic for it, but it's just like, I just did Splatterhouse on the Namco arcade collection, and that is checkpoints, and that works fine. But yeah, for the games that didn't have that kind of checkpoint structure, you kind of need to set rules for yourself and stick to them if you want to kind of make it a challenge. But also, it can just be fun, powering through it still. But
that's the thing. The game seemed to me a little bit unfair in terms of there's a lot of levels. I don't see myself ever kind of learning them. It's one thing if you're playing, I don't know, like, what is Ikaruga, like 6 levels or something?
5, if I remember.
5, yeah. So it's kind of conceivable that you might learn them. Like, that might not automatically make you good at them.
Well, also, you can unlock them to, like, practice them out of sequence. So you don't have to play through the first couple of levels to learn the third one, which is like more difficult or more complicated or whatever. So that's a nice touch.
Right. So, but here it's more of a situation where, I was playing co-op. The rules are a little bit different in co-op because it's a little bit like, there was another game that did that recently. Like, basically, as long as one of us was in play, we were not sent back to the beginning of the level. Normally, when you're playing single player, if you waste your 2 lives and you continue, then it starts you back at the beginning of the level. But here, because, you know, like, we would never be game overed at the same time, the level just kept going. The person who died could just pick up, we would relay each other, basically. So it just made it kind of tedious. Like, by default, we had infinite continues. And so we just kind of, in half an hour, went through the whole game, then went through the whole game again, because the game is structured that way. You see the credits, I think, only after the second playthrough.
Ghosts and Goblins.
The game gets less fair. I was going to say harder, but, like, really, it's just, like, you just keep dying and dying.
Yeah, it just becomes more of a grunt. We want more of your quarters, please.
Yeah, so because of that experience, and because, you know, by the second playthrough, we were just like, try to shoot something, whoops, I died, try to shoot something, I died, try to get the power up, okay, I died, continue. You know, like, it was kind of, it seemed impossible to overcome anything, you know, in these levels without just ruining yourself.
It very likely is. To be honest, it very likely is designed to not. I mean, this goes back to Golden Axe, like having health that just ticks down.
Right.
You're not doing anything wrong, but fuck you. You only get 5 minutes on that quarter.
Yeah. So it got tedious, and I kind of felt like I had been suckered by, like, oh, look at these goofy, you know, characters and cutscenes. And it,
look at Bobby.
Know, in the end,
he's a baby flying a jet plane.
Yeah, yeah. It's, but the thing is, like, you can get that part of the experience just by looking, you know, online. Like,
it's on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah. You just look at the screenshots of the stupid things they say, and then you're good. But so yeah. So and then I tried to play it by myself, and so I got to the point where like the last level on the first playthrough just could not get anywhere. Like the two lives was not enough to beat that last boss. And because I was playing by myself, I was sent back to the beginning of the level every time. So it was not fun, and I felt like, oh, crap. You know, like, I've been more selective with the software that I've been buying on Switch because I accrued such a backlog in the Wii days and then Wii U because of, you know, that kind of impulse to, like, oh, this looks funny or weird or whatever. I need to experience it for myself. It's only, like, $8, whatever. And then, like, I've got, like, this huge collection of things, of games that I don't really care for. So I've felt like I've been trying to avoid doing that with a Switch, and I felt like, oh, this is my first failure. Like, this is my first really bad decision here. Because, you know, because Hamster was, you know, revealed to be working on Nintendo arcade games, I decided to take a deeper look into the options, and there's some interesting stuff there. First, like, you can turn off the infinite continues. You can set a limit for yourself, which is, you know, it's neat that there's that option. I don't feel like it adds anything for me because I'm not going to take advantage of it. Like, I don't feel like, oh yeah, like, five continues seems like a reasonable amount of, you know, tries to get through this game, and I'm going to limit myself to that. Like, I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me to play it that way, to impose my kind of, you know, a little bit arbitrary limits like that. You can choose, like, to have infinite credits, not credits, but lives, so that makes it even, you know, easier. But you can also choose to, so that continues will not send you back to the beginning of the level. So yeah, you've got a lot of flexibility for the difficulty there. And yeah, there is a difficulty slider also, which I'm actually not sure if it does anything. I'm not sure what it changes.
It probably scales your damage.
Well, yeah, maybe, but I seem to do the same damage for, you know, on anywhere on that scale, and there seem to be the same number of bullets on the screen, and so I'm not sure what that did. There's an option to turn on auto fire, which is very appreciated.
Yeah, you need that.
Yeah, you've got several screen filters, you know, for interlaced and stuff, and that's neat. I get the feeling that Nintendo arcade games were not designed with the whole put a quarter in to continue exactly where you left off. So we're not going to see those kinds of options. Like, no. I don't think, like, okay, you just, you know, fell into that pit and versus Super Mario Brothers, just press, you know, continue, and you're going to restart, you know, at the edge of that pit. Like, so that's not going to be, I don't think, in the Nintendo arcade games, that Hamster is going to bring us. But the fact that there are so many different options makes me pretty positive about the work that they're going to do on them. And then there's also stuff that I did not check out the first time around, and it kind of changed my opinion a little bit on the game. First, there you can choose between the Japanese ROM, what's it called? Sonic Fighters?
It's called, hold on, I know this. It's called Sonic Wings.
Sonic Wings. So yeah, so you can play Sonic Wings 2, which I don't know what's different other than the text being in Japanese.
I think that and some of the characters have different names. Besides that, then yeah, it's the same.
Right. So you've got the choice between 99%
less English.
Right. but you've also got Caravan Mode, which I did not know what that was. I was like, Caravan, what is that? Is that their name for Tate mode or something? I've got, that means nothing. And I select it, and it's a mode where you've got 5 minutes to, and one continue to make it as far as you can and as many points as you can, and you've got online leaderboards.
That's cool.
And yeah, that is very cool. And so you can't turn on the auto fire. You've got a default kind of setting, difficulty setting, and it's just a matter of trying to score the highest number of points possible. And there's not that much competition right now because I think I made it. I'm in the top 100. Unfortunately, there's no filter to just see your friends. Unless there is, but I just don't have any friends playing it, which is entirely possible.
Very.
But in the Nintendo arcade games, if they've got online leaderboards, I'd really like to see that.
That is something that comes up in some of these hamster games. So there's a good chance.
Yeah, I mean, the Namco Switch collection is very similar with those challenge modes I talked about. You have to use sort of standard settings, and then you get online leaderboards and all that kind of stuff. And in terms of the whole caravan mode specifically, if you remember Star Soldier R for WiiWare.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was basically the whole game, wasn't it? It was
right.
The caravan mode, the game.
right.
That was something. I forget exactly the origin of that term, but it's definitely something that's been it. It was part of the Japanese shooter scene back in the 90s. Having these score challenge kind of sections. Trying to create a kind of competitive scene out of the shooter genre.
Right. So it's I think it's my favorite way to play. And if I'm out and about, initially I thought, okay, I'm going to delete this game and never touch it again, because playing through the story was not that much fun, especially not with infinite continues. But this caravan mode is actually a lot of... I could see myself okay, I've got 5 minutes, I'm going to play this shoot 'em up. I'm going to try to do better, improve my ranking if I've got a Wi-Fi connection. You've got 8 different fighters and characters, and who you pick seems to determine what the second level is going to be. So, the fighters do have kind of different, weapon spreads or, different secondary, usually... screen clearing power-ups.
Yeah.
So you can experiment with that, and you can experiment with which character has the second level that pays off the most. And so I could see myself playing that a bunch of times. And then there's a high score mode, which does not have the 5-minute limit, but does limit you to one continue, and you have to make it as far as you can.
Yeah, it's just how you can. What's your best score in the regular game with one credit?
Yeah. So now my opinion has turned on it. I think it's a fun shooter. It's pretty well done. It looks fantastic. The sprite work is just kind of amazing. Things explode good, and there's just not only there are
up real nice,
yeah, and not only there are wacky characters saying stupid things, but
very stupid things. I don't think you can't undersell how dumb these things are.
Right, but there are also some fun details, in the background and the levels. It's no parodious, it's not a comedy game, but you'll have
it's not Mecha Keaton is in this game.
Yeah, well, anyway, so, but there might be some fun stuff, you can see, I don't know if you're trying to free these countries or destroy them, but there might be, a giant Ferris wheel, and if you shoot at it enough, it's gonna, get off its inch, yeah, and then you destroy it, and you get more points, I suppose. One cringy thing, I don't know when this came out.
92, I think. 93.
Right. So I guess we're, over censoring levels set in New York, where you see the two towers, the twin towers, and you can actually kind of destroy buildings to get money inside them to get extra points.
That's how that works, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So So that's that game. It's pretty good. I'm enjoying it. And the other thing that I've been playing is I got from the library a copy of Super Bomberman R, and I'm you know, I've talked about Bomberman before. It's not my favorite Hudson game. I keep trying to give it chances, but it's really not the gameplay for me. So this, you know, iteration does not change that. And in fact, I like it less than the Bomberman 94 that's on the Wii U Virtual Console or the Wii Virtual Console, because whereas like the 94 version had kangaroos you know, like colors, like it had some really eye-popping colors, like everything is just not garish, but like very bright and very cartoony, and it looks great. And it's also easy to, the action is easy to interpret. Interpret.
Yeah, you're just emphasizing the wrong syllable.
But yeah, I know what you mean in terms of that clear kind of grid look.
Well, it's especially important because you are on a grid.
Yeah, you're on a grid.
And you're trying to set bombs at the right spot on that grid. And if you, I don't know, like I was playing with Karen and we kept, you know, bombing the wrong things. We kept thinking like our feet were not where we thought they were.
Yeah, this was especially pronounced when the game launched with its default camera angle, which
The single player, wasn't it? Like had some really weird camera angle moments, and it was, yeah. So, I mean, this is probably less of a problem than it was initially because it's been quite significantly
quite
changed.
Actively is still supporting it. In fact, they announced more stuff this week for this
game. But
new characters in a new mode.
But despite like the new camera options, like I turned them on and I still have a problem with it because you still have the camera is still at a weird angle, and there's a lot of like ramps and there's different floors on the various stages, and that just messes me up, you know. It's not easy. It's not like you can't tell quickly, like, oh, this platform is a platform. It's higher than where I'm at, and I can't put a bomb there. And like these enemies that are on top of it can't reach me, and I can't reach them. I gotta climb over there on that ramp. I don't know. Like it's an issue that would go away as I learned the stages, I suppose. But I'm not gonna get to that point. And yeah, like I've seen some people ask me online, like, I haven't played it since it came out. Like, did they fix the online? Apparently, it was very laggy. And yes, they fixed it. I played one game. I was ranked like something like baby mode or anyway. Yeah, I was
tiny baby.
Right, something like that. And the first person that came into my match was ranked god.
Oh, good. So you won, is what you're telling me.
No, he won pretty handily against me and someone else who was ranked a novice. So.
I'm a. Did you like everyone in that room must have thought, oh no.
Yeah, I can say with certainty that the problem was not lag. Like lag did not kill me there. It was entirely my lack of skills and the matchmaking. So yeah, but it's not just like the camera angle, like the colors don't pop, you know, like it's trying for, I guess, like more realistic colors a little bit. So even like stages set in a lush jungle setting still look kind of drab. There's still an awful lot of brown. And yeah, and I tried to get through the story mode, but you know, the characters, all are voice acted. All the voice actors went to the same anime voice acting school as Puyo Puyo Tetris. They're all very screamy. Not, you know, not necessarily screaming, just, you know, screamy. Like
they have have naturally shouty voices.
Right. And so I skipped through most of that. And I faced two bosses that were kind of interesting, but none of them were a chimpanzee controlling a remote-controlled banana like I faced in Bomberman 94. So, again, like, it kind of loses on that front. So, yeah, it's not my thing.
What can contend with Bomberman 94 on that basis, though?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I love Chrono Trigger, you know, probably more than the next guy, but can't beat Bomberman 94 on that score.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to think what might be. Ape Escape probably has something like that at some point. But yeah, I mean, that point you're getting into, like, this is a game built for this. So,
right.
Yeah. That's okay. It's not left field at that point, is it?
No, it's just in play. I'm looking for crossover between the Puyo Puyo Tetris and Super Bomberman R cast and.
Yeah, well, I would assume that probably the same group of people.
Well, to be fair, the cast of both of these games is way more people than there's any reason for this to be happening.
Yeah, well, yeah, like I know none of the characters in Puyo Puyo Tetris, but there's an awful lot of them.
There's
and,
like 400.
And basically, each Bomberman, the Bomberman brothers, they should be called siblings. There are some girls in there. And they're all called like blue or white or black or green. And they've each got one personality. So that's fun.
There you go. Actually, you know what? There may be no overlap. Great. Well,
anyway, that's it.
So we're going a little bit shorter this week. A little bit. We have 90 minutes to do business with three people.
I told you last week about Joe Biden's big comments on the return of Metroid 2D scrolling, side-scrolling gameplay.
Yeah.
Big fucking deal or something?
Exactly.
I'm
glad he's got international recognition for that.
I want that to be like when he picks his quote for his epitaph. I want it to just be that.
Yeah.
I was kind of a big fucking deal.
So, yeah, it was always going to take a while. But
yeah, it is what it is. I had a lot to say, but I don't know that I spent a lot of time saying it, but I had a lot to say about Final Fantasy 15. So we're actually going to kind of call it here. You know, John being out, it doesn't feel right to go into new business until I've hired his replacement. Listener mail. So... On that, stay tuned for who I've hired next week, because he's probably going to be Tom Frindeman. And you can send us an email in the meantime to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And on that, we're actually going to end the show early this week, and we're going to give you back half an hour of your time. So, Greg, what's our end music?
Well, we got a listener request from Ben, who to coincide with the release of SteamWorld Dig 2, which is locked
which is
and loaded on my Switch. Yeah, if I want to change of pace for Metroid, playing Metroid twice through, or possibly even three times through, I've got that to go to. It's faring very well with reviews and stuff. We got a couple of very complimentary reviews up at NintendoWorldReport.com. Ben requested the title theme from the original SteamWorld Dig, which, speaking of things sounded sort of Metroid Prime-y, this very much is basically Metroid Prime mashed up with Morricone of the Spaghetti Western movies, specifically Ecstasy of Gold, which was once used for a title of the show, Ecstasy of Head Gold.
There you go.
Was that Cop the Recruit, that reference?
Because Head Gold is a quote right out of Cop the Recruit that John glommed onto because he thought that phrase was amazing. Which,
so you go,
fair,
yeah.
That phrase is amazing.
Morricone is apt to get mashed up with just about anything. But yeah, this is a really fun mix of those two things, and I'm really looking forward to playing Dig 2 sometime soon. I don't know whether I'll take a Metroidvania vacation or something, but I will be getting to it somewhat soon.
Fair enough. Well, on that, bye everybody.
Bye. Bye-bye.